They are elected by you. I am elected by you. I'm constrained as they are constrained by a system that our founders put in place.
The founders separated power because they knew it was the best way to protect our citizens.
Keep your eye on the ball. Structure is destiny.
This is Necessary and Proper, the podcast of the Federal Society's Article 1 initiative. All views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Federal Society.
Federalist Society's Student Division recently concluded its Federalist Papers Book Club, which ran weekly on Tuesday evenings for 10 one-hour sessions. In this session, Dr. John S. Baker Jr. discusses Federalist Number 62, 63, 65, and 66, which discuss the Senate. We hope you enjoy.
Welcome, everyone. This is the eighth session of our book club. And tonight there's a lot to cover. I have more slides than any other time. And we're going to begin, though, with a question from our live audience. This is from Dave. He asks, if the Senate is a check and balance against the larger body, what is preventing the Senate from becoming nothing more than an extension of that body, the larger body? If the majority party of the House is also the majority party of the Senate, is there an inherent risk, you know, that they'll work together too much? Down to the next sentence. Did the founders feel that that difference in terms for which they were elected would take care of this? First of all, every time one party gets all three branches, the media says, now we're going to end gridlock in government. Doesn't happen. Now, the Democrats are generally better at it than the Republicans, but it's not only the term in office that differentiates them. It is the fact laid out earlier that, as Publius says, the two houses are shaped in ways to make it such that they won't really get along except as absolutely necessary. It's part of the whole design to make it difficult to get legislation passed. Remember, I talked about gridlock. This is intentional gridlock. To force compromise, to force more than simple majoritarianism, to force what would amount to consensus. But let's look at democracy in America. There's an interesting quote that I love from de Tocqueville. And I want to read all of this if I can. There are certain laws of a democratic nature which contribute, nevertheless, to correct in some measure the dangerous tendencies of democracy. Now, he's a French aristocrat who is trying to figure out by looking at America, how do you make democracy work? Because Europeans didn't think it could work. Not only that, they went through a revolution that was much more damaging than anything that occurred in our revolution, detaching ourselves from England. So he's interested and he observes a lot of things and listen to what he says. On entering the House of Representatives of Washington, one is struck by the vulgar demeanor. Okay, he's a French aristocrat. What is vulgar demeanor to him? You know, ordinary people would say, fine, they're representing us. But in any event, vulgar demeanor of that great assembly. The eye frequently does not discover a man of celebrity within the walls. That confirms what Publius said to the Anti-Federalists, that it would be open to everyone. The Anti-Federalists didn't believe that. Well, 50 years later, de Tocqueville is confirming that. Now, to his notion, that's not a good sign. But to Americans, that's a very good sign. They're almost all obscure individuals whose names present no associations to the mind. They are mostly village lawyers, men in trade, or even persons belonging to the lower classes of society. Wow, how terrible. But remember, Justice Scalia said the most important book after the Federalists to read is Democracy in America. This is an outside observer, but he is confirming 50 years later that what the Federalists predicted would happen. In the next paragraph, a few yards distant from this spot is the door to the other Senate, which contains within a small space a large proportion of the celebrated men of America. Scarcely an individual is to be perceived in who does not recall the idea of an active and illustrious career. The Senate is comprised of eloquent advocates, distinguished generals, wise magistrates, and statesmen of note, whose language world at all times do honor to the most remarkable parliaments in debates in Europe. Now, for a Frenchman to admit that this country that's only been around for 50 years, that in the Senate, they're the equal of Europeans, was really something. Now, there are those who would say, well, you have to dismiss all this because after all, this is still the heart of slavery. They were represented in the Senate. Well, this is not a commentary on policy. This is a commentary on representation. In fact, the same Southerners were in the House of Representatives. And indeed, in the House of Representatives, they were overrepresented in terms of population due to the three-fifths clause. So there is a marked difference, and that goes to Dave's question. It's the whole design that is producing different types of legislative bodies. That was the aim, that was the accomplishment, at least before the 17th Amendment. On to 62, five issues regarding the Senate. So he marches through methodically their qualifications, their appointment of them by the state legislatures, the equality of representation on the Senate, the number of senators and the term for which they were elected, the powers vested in the Senate. So he's going to march through this, and some of these I'll go more quickly through. The age is higher, it's 30. The number of years they have to be in the United States before being eligible is longer. And the highlighted part, the propriety of these distinctions, is explained by the nature of the senatorial trust, which requires greater extent of information and stability of character. Requires at the same time that the senators should have reached a period of life most likely to supply these advantages. And again, confirmed by de Tocqueville. Foreign influence was a concern, as it still is today. The term of 9 years is related to making sure that they've been weaned of their attachment to the countries from which they came. There's always a concern, both in Congress and in the executive, of foreign influence. The apportionment of the appointment by the legislatures probably, he says, is the most congenial with the public opinion. It's a double advantage of favoring a select appointment and of giving to the state government such an agency in the formation of the federal government. So when the states complain in court, as they did on many occasions, especially during the Marshall Court, after all, it's your state legislature that is sending people to the Senate. You had the choice. That's why it was so astounding, really, that it was the states that got rid of their power. Next, the equal representation. This is all about a compromise. He doesn't say it's not. No, he recognizes it's the result of a compromise between our pretensions of the large and small states. That among the independent and sovereign states bound together by a simple league, that's where it comes from, the parties, however, unequal in size, ought to have an equal share in the common councils. It does not appear to be without some reason that is in a compound republic. Now, often people complain, as I think they should, about the United Nations, which gives one vote to the US and one vote to very tiny countries. That's a confederation. But our confederation was designed for a political union, even though it wasn't yet a government. So the difference between confederation and political union is still very important. Compromise is not based on any theory, you know, and he doesn't even try by any standard, a part of the Constitution, which is allowed on all hands to be the result, not of theory, but of a spirit of amity. Namely, the small states weren't going to go along with anything unless the big states agreed to equal representation in the Senate, the so-called Connecticut Compromise. The last sentence, a government founded on principles more consonant to the wishes of the larger states is not likely to be obtained from the smaller states. This was a non-negotiable deal, basically, or we wouldn't have had a constitution. But he goes on to say that, you know, this might turn out all right. The equal vote allowed to each state is at once constitutional recognition of the portion of sovereignty remaining in the individual states and an instrument for preserving that residual sovereignty. So then he's going to go on to say, you know, this might not turn out so badly. I'm just going to do the last sentence on this. But as the facility and excess of lawmaking seem to be the diseases to which our governments are most liable, it is not impossible that this part of the Constitution may be more convenient in practice than it appears to many in contemplation. And I think for many, certainly those in the small states, they think it is better. It is certainly slowed down legislation, and that is what the Senate is all about. And of course, now there's a battle over whether or not to eliminate the filibuster, and that would change a lot of things. But there are those who want to speed up legislation, get more of it, and there are those, as Madison wanted, to slow down legislation in order to make sure it was better crafted and that it didn't exhibit the problems exhibited by legislation passed too quickly. The number and the term of senators. In order to ascertain these, it will be necessary to review the consequences which a republic must suffer from the want of such an institution. This is going to be critical. I mean, the Senate is a linchpin in this thing, and that's why I'm always coming back to the 17th Amendment. I think more than anything, the damage done by the 17th Amendment is not only responsible for all kinds of changes in terms of what the Senate does, it doesn't block legislation like it did, and also because the qualities that are sought for in the Senate, many of them have simply over time evaporated, and I would blame it on the 17th Amendment. So a second house of the legislative branch just creates a double security. First, it is the misfortunate incident to Republican government, though in a less degree to other governments, that those who administer it forget the obligation to their constituents. A lot of Americans feel that way and have felt that way for a while with regard to recent Congresses. A salutary check on the government, what is the Senate? It doubles the security to the people by requiring the concurrence of two distinct bodies in schemes of usurpation or perfidy, where the ambition or corruption of the one would otherwise be sufficient. Restraining the passions, that's really the large part of the job of the House. So there's a good current example. The House is ready, but hasn't yet passed the DC bill on statehood. And in the bill, you wouldn't believe, but in the bill, it appears, and I've asked some of the staff in the House, it appears that the authors of the bill think that they can eliminate the 23rd Amendment to the Constitution, which gives the district a seat in the House, that they can eliminate that simply by a resolution of both houses of Congress. Well, it may not go forward because of the filibuster in the Senate, but it's clearly a bill that has not been well thought out. Yes, there's a lot of passion for it, but it's not thought out. The body which is to correct this infirmity ought itself be free from it and consequently ought to be less numerous. It ought, moreover, to possess great firmness and consequentially ought to hold the authority by a tenure of considerable duration. There is more power to each senator. Each senator is much more prominent in DC than any member of the House except the senior leadership in the House. A legislative body chosen for a short term will make serious errors. I just gave the example of the bill that I've read in the DC, on the DC statehood. Another defect to be supplied by a Senate lies in the want of due acquaintance with the objects and principles of legislation. It is not possible an assembly of men called for the most part from pursuits of private nature continued in apportionment for a short time. Many of the states, the ideal, the Jeffersonian ideal, was that legislatures would meet for very short periods of time. Ordinary people would go. That's certainly good for part of the legislation. But for other aspects of legislation, it's not adequate. Should, if left to wholly to themselves, escape a variety of important errors in the exercise of their legislative trust. That is the reality, that it takes a while. I think I mentioned it before when we were doing the House. A member of the House who represented my district in Louisiana years ago said it took him 6 years before he was even ignored by anybody in Washington. Legislative blunders and instability in the states, and he gives some examples. No small share of the present embarrassments of America is to be charged on the blunders of our government. What indeed are all the repealing, explaining, and amending laws which fill and disgrace our voluminous codes, but so many monuments of deficient wisdom? We've got a lot of that in the current Congress and have had for some time. The requirements of good government, and good government as they understand it, is not the same as what typical so-called good government people espouse. Good government people with whom I'm familiar with are all focused on ethics and government statutes, never apparently paying much attention to human nature and what they're trying to deal with. A good example of that was the independent counsel statute, which was upheld by the Supreme Court over the lone dissent of Justice Scalia. And years later, people wondered, how was it that Justice Scalia was so prescient as to understand what would happen, that the statute would be abused? Hey, he understood government. He understood the Federalists. A good government implies two things: fidelity to the object of government, which is the happiness of the people. Secondly, a knowledge of the means by which it can be best obtained. Some governments are deficient in both these qualities, not our government. Most governments are deficient in the first. That is, they don't care about the happiness of the people. Both the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists were united on that end. I scruple not to assert that in American governments, too little attention has been paid to the last, that is, to competence, the means. The federal Constitution avoids the error, and what merits particular notice, it provides for the last in a mode which increases the security of the first. That is, if you don't understand competently how to implement the tools to achieve the happiness of the people, you may have good intentions, but you will also be failures in terms of achieving that end. The need for stability. People don't really understand the importance. Sometimes we take it for granted about the stability in the U.S. But in recent years, especially last summer, with the violence and the cancel culture, which is rocking the United States, they're beginning to appreciate the need for stability. The reason why countries still flock to our fiat currency, the dollar, and invest in the United States is because of stability. The problem is we are experiencing times in which one administration is favorable to commerce and another administration is being pulled in the direction of socialism, which, as Madison, not using the name, called very wicked. The mutability in public councils arising from a rapid succession of new members, however qualified they may be, points out in the strongest manner the necessity of some stable institution in the government. Every new election in the states is found to change one half of the representatives. Now notice, it's interesting, since the 17th Amendment, and with it, the building of the administrative state, the stability is found in the administrative agencies, because Congress has, in large part, through independent agencies and other means, kept those agencies pretty much under its control, even when there is a president of a different party who doesn't agree to what the administrative state is doing. There has to be stability somewhere. The problem in the administrative state, of course, is those who hold those positions of power are not accountable to the electorate. From the change of men must proceed a change of opinions, and from a change of opinions, a change of measures. But a continual change, even of good measures, is inconsistent with every rule of prudence and every prospect of success. The remark is verified in private life and becomes more just as well as more important in national transactions. After the change in the House leadership due to the involvement of the Tea Party movement back in, I think it was 2010, I had one of their leaders, a lawyer, call me and say, "We're all upset because nothing's changed in Washington." And I explained to him, "Look, you can't get permanent change unless you prevail in three subsequent successive elections. It is deliberate. The Senate is structured to only overturn one third each time. What this does is to allow a radical change, but it temporizes it. It domesticates it. It makes it do a slow roll if, in fact, it is going to be effective. Part of it is to see whether the movement peters out. If it doesn't peter out, it'll take six elections at least in order to make a change. And even then, with the administrative state, it's not sufficient any longer. So we can't even really do that kind of a change that was allowed for within the context of stability. The remark is verified in private life and becomes more just as well as important in national transactions. Mutability in government is a source of innumerable problems. In the first place, it forfeits the respect and confidence of other nations and of all the advantages connected with national character. Well, many conservatives don't care about the opinion of other nations, but certainly at the beginning they did, because we were a small country. We were subject to some of the whims of European nations. We needed to borrow from them. We needed to show that we weren't a bunch of radicals and that we could be in fact trusted. But it's still important today. The balance of power between the United States and China is going to be decided not only by what China does, but by what the U.S. does. And if nations, especially in Asia, but also in Europe, get the opinion widespread that you can't trust the United States, you will quickly see a loss of international prestige and power for the United States, and you will see it go to China. That is a given if we are not very careful. And it's not only Tucker Carlson has been talking about it, Bill Maher, of all people, is talking about it. And when the left and right can agree on that, then we may begin to become more serious in terms of what is a national priority. Mutable governments poison liberty and undermine the rule of law. The internal effects of mutable policy are still more calamitous. It poisons the blessings of liberty itself. It will be of little avail to the people that the laws are made by men of their own choice if the laws be so voluminous that they cannot be read, or so incoherent that they cannot be understood. That is where we are. I've cataloged the growth of federal criminal law. It's over 5,000 crimes, not counting all the criminal penalties attached to regulations, which run into the hundreds of thousands. There's no way anyone can know this. What does that mean? It means complete discretion in those who have the power of investigation and prosecution. And these statutes are so ambiguous and should be classed as constitutionally vague in many cases, but they aren't, because they're done by the Congress and the courts, if the same statute had been passed by a state, would be declared void for vagueness, are not being so declared. So the idea that we actually have a rule of law, which we pride ourselves on, is really, we have the rule of rules. That is not the same as the rule of law. And what happens? No man who knows what the law is today can guess what the law will be tomorrow. Law is defined to be a rule of action, but how can that be a rule which is little known and less fixed? People are not paying attention to this. This is a very real danger. Under the Trump administration, there was an executive order or two and a Justice Department policy requiring that criminal laws and regulations not be charged against someone unless they could prove a mens rea, that is, a guilty mind. One of the first things the Biden administration did was to revoke those executive orders. Apparently, the one at DOJ has not yet been revoked. That's amazing. It puts us all at jeopardy. That the idea that you must show actual guilt is a protection against the abuse of power. It advantages the clever and the wealthy. And anybody who's familiar with Washington in administrative law will understand this. Another effect of the public instability is the unreasonable advantage it gives to the sagacious, the enterprising, and the moneyed few over the industrious and unfettered mass, uninformed mass of the people. This is what many populists, left and right, are furious about, and they have every right to be furious. It's wrong, it's corrupt. Why? How do they get this advantage? Every new regulation concerning commerce or revenue or in any manner affecting the value of different species of property presents a new harvest to those who watch the change and can trace the consequences. A harvest reared not by themselves, but by the toils and cares of the great body of their fellow citizens. This is a state of things to which it may be said with the same truth that laws are made for the few, not for the many. That is undermining the faith in our government. There are so many regulations being promulgated, we know. And who can read those? Well, lots of law firms can, and they do, and they provide their information to corporations and others who can pay for that. Can the ordinary citizen pay for that? Well, you can subscribe to certain journals that would give you the information, but will you get the inside information? No. And again, this is where we have departed very greatly from the not only the text, but the institutions created by the text of the Constitution. National improvements require a steady system of national policy. A lot of people have observed from President Trump on to Tucker Carlson and others that, and are, that China's building like crazy. Now, sure, they're doing it under a type of government that we would never accept. It's not a democratic government. Nevertheless, they're doing it. And we can't even get an infrastructure bill through the Congress, even though it has been tried for a while. Great injury results from an unstable government. The want of confidence in the public councils damps every useful undertaking, the success and profit of which may depend on a continuance of existing arrangements. What prudent merchant will hazard his fortunes in any new branch of commerce when he knows not that the plans may be rendered unlawful before they can be executed? What farmer, et cetera, the same thing. Stability is necessary in order for those who risk their labor and their capital to create new enterprises. That's what's made the country great. That is what is necessary in terms of a stable government. If you had the anti-federalist view that there shouldn't be a Senate or the Senate should be very much like the House, there would never have been the long-term vision to create and to plan. In a word, no great improvements or laudable enterprises can go forward which require the auspices of a steady system of national policy. But the most deplorable effect of all is that the diminution of attachment and reverence, which steals into the hearts of people. Recent polls are showing an increase in the notion that the country should divide itself between red and blue towards a political system which betrays so many marks of infirmity and disappoints so many of their flattering hopes. No government, any more than an individual, will long be respected without being truly respectable, or being truly respectable without possessing a certain portion of order and stability. So, a question from Ms. Hollers. Talking about bicameralism, she asks, as such, the different requirement and duration of the Senate seems to suggest that Publius saw the Senate as an institution for more virtuous men. Well, Publius always hopes for virtue, but he understands and plans for lack of virtue. Now, if we go back to the quote from de Tocqueville, it would appear that there's, quote, a lot of competence, a lot of status. Does that always translate to virtue? No, but it may translate to competence. But here's another view from de Tocqueville, more generally about the problem of virtue and competence in a democratic system. The men who are entrusted with the direction of public affairs in the United States are frequently inferior, note the House, not the Senate, both in point of capacity and of morality, to those whom aristocratic institutions would raise to power. Okay, granted, we're not an aristocratic government. Now, some will accuse the Senate of being aristocratic. If by that you mean natural aristocracy, natural ability, as opposed to hereditary ability, yes, that was part of the plan. But their interest is identified and confounded with that of the majority of their fellow citizens, as it should be in the House. They may frequently be faithless and frequently mistaken, but they will never systematically adopt a line of conduct opposed to the will of the majority. Well, that was true for a long time. I'm not sure that it still applies today. And it is impossible that they should give a dangerous or an exclusive tendency to the government. So on to Federalist 63, the Senate and national character. This is something that is not talked about today, but it needs to be talked about. And so I'll spend a little bit of time on it. The fifth desideratum, illustrating the utility of the Senate, is the want of a due sense of national character. Well, there was a sense when it was the most exclusive club in the world. Without a select and stable member of the government, the esteem of foreign powers would not only be forfeited by an unenlightened and variable policy proceeding from the causes already mentioned, but the national councils will not possess that sensibility to the opinion of the world, which is perhaps not less necessary in order to merit than it is to obtain its respect and confidence. This is especially true regarding the dollar. The dollar is a fiat currency. Most of the currencies in the world are fiat currencies. Swiss is different. The fiat currency that has no hard money backing to it has to rely completely on trust. People around the world in times of crisis dump their money into US treasuries. If that ever stops, and China and Iran and Russia are working to stop it, if and when that stops, life in the United States will transform in ways that you can't imagine. In ways that you can't imagine. Most fiat currencies are worth basically nothing, and you get skyrocketing inflation, and you can't travel outside the country because nobody will take your currency. Let's hope that never happens to the United States. But there are many people, even in government, who believe that somehow it is the destiny of the United States, regardless of how idiotic we sometimes behave, that nothing is ever going to change. That is not true. The national character not derived from numerous and changeable bodies, yet, however requisite a sense of national character may be, it is evident that it can never be sufficiently possessed by a numerous and changeable body. It can only be found in a number so small that a sensible degree of the praise and blame of public measures, the praise and blame of public measures, that's where accountability comes in. And the Senate for some decades now has been devoted, just like the House, to avoiding accountability. Without that accountability and responsibility, we're not going to get long-term policy, and you're not going to get it from a changeable body. Or in an assembly so durably invested with public trust that the pride and consequences of its members may sensibly be incorporated with the reputation and prosperity of the community. Think about Social Security. Every number of years, we are presented with what is said to be a crisis in Social Security. In the meantime, the Congress has kicked the can down the road. Why do they kick the can down the road? Well, they may not ever have to face the problem if they're not in office. They can blame somebody else. That's not supposed to be the way it works, okay? But it only works if you make it work that way. That is, people have to be forced to take accountability. The name of the game with the administrative state is to allow Congress to pass more laws, shift them off to the bureaucracy, control the bureaucracy through the budgets, and then when things go wrong, as they did in the Fannie Mae mess, those who actually caused the mess are excoriating the agencies for doing what happened or blaming them when in fact it was Congress's fault. I add a sixth defect. Responsibility, in order to be reasonable, must be limited to objects within the power of the responsible party. That's a big problem. That is, Congress has taken on so many subjects that don't belong under its power. They can't possibly get to know them or know them well enough. And that gives the incentive then to kick them off to the bureaucracy. And that then also allows them to regulate others. How do they do that? Well, I call it a shakedown game. And that is, some years ago, a couple of members of Congress said, well, you know, we ought to be regulating hedge funds. Hedge funds up to that point had never really got involved in politics. I know because my oldest daughter at the time was working for the Chamber of Commerce across the street from the White House. And she said instantly overnight, hedge funds became the largest donors to the chamber. Good for the chamber, good for contributions, bad for the country, bad for the hedge funds. And in order to be effectual, must relate to the operations of that power of which a ready and proper judgment can be formed by the constituents. That's the problem. People can't make adequate judgments. And the media doesn't help. It doesn't give you the kind of information that it really needs. Why? They're protecting members of Congress and especially the agencies. Why? Why do reporters do that? It's not just that they like liberal policies. It's also that they want access. If the media actually did expose a lot of things going on in agencies, guess what? Those in the agencies would no longer give them the leaks that make their job a lot easier. We don't have the investigative journalists that we once had who are willing to go out there regardless of the price. But it's a game between the media and members of both Congress and in the agencies. The Senate and long-term planning. We talked a little bit about this, but let's talk some more about it. The objects of government may be divided into two general classes, the short term and the long term. the other depending on a succession of well-chosen and well-connected measures, which have a gradual and perhaps unobserved operation. This is why you don't want term limits in the Senate. Although before the 17th Amendment, states would have been able to term limit their senators if they chose to do so. An assembly elected for so short a term as to be unable to provide more than one or two links in a chain of measures on which the general welfare may essentially depend ought not to be answerable for the final result. Nor is it possible for the people to estimate the share of influence which their annual assemblies may respectively have on the events resulting from the mixed transactions of several years. All of this is a system of accountability. And as Federalist Point 48 points out, Congress will find all kinds of ways, members of Congress, to get around the attempts to make them accountable. And they've been very successful at doing that. The proper remedy for mutable government is an additional body in the legislative department, which having sufficient permanency to provide for such objects as to require a continued attention and a train of measures may justly and effectively answerable for the attainment of those objects. In the last session on the House, I mentioned the problem of term limiting chairmen in the, and I specifically referred to the Senate, but here I want to elaborate on that a little bit. There was a time when chairs of committees in the Senate were very, very, very powerful because of their long term. And in some cases, they could certainly abuse that power. On the other hand, they really knew the subject matter. As I think I said before, and I want to repeat, especially from the South, once you got elected, you could pretty much count on the fact that you would be there indefinitely. And that was an incentive to really learn the subject matter, knowing that eventually you would be chairman of the committee. So I think of the late Senator Russell Long from Louisiana, who was the master of tax. And he headed the tax committee for years and years and years and years. And he knew everything about it. Well, not every member can know everything about every subject. The length of time there sure gives those with the knowledge and the expertise, it gives them a certain standing. And yes, they will have, in a sense, more influence than a junior senator. And that's still that way today. But it is difficult to look around and find that there are senators with a great depth of knowledge on any particular subject. There may be some exceptions, but it's not the kind of depth of knowledge that we once had. Now, does this really make a difference? Well, it depends on whether you think that long-term measures are really important. The Senate as a restraint on the occasional errors and delusions of the people. This is where Madison is extremely careful and tactful. To a people as little blinded by prejudice or corrupted by flattery as those whom I address, I shall not scruple to add that such an institution may be sometimes necessary as a defense to the people against their own temporary errors and delusions. Very tactful. You know, you people that we represent sometimes go off the deep end. And the Senate is necessary to restrain you. As the cool and deliberate sense of the community ought in all governments, and actually will in all free governments, ultimately prevail over the views of rulers. So there are particular moments in public affairs when the people, stimulated by more irregular passions or some illicit advantage or misled by artificial representation of interested men, may call for measures which they themselves will afterwards be the most ready and to lament and condemn. Certainly, You can say that about the civil rights movement. And once it was able to get the proper legislation, you saw Southern senators flip. You saw Strom Thurmond and Russell Long flip from being segregationist to not being segregationist because they wanted to get reelected. The most important right is really the right to vote. The Senate is a temperate and respectable body protecting the people from error. How salutary will be the interference of some temperate and respectable body of citizens to suspend the blow mediated by the people against themselves until reason, justice, and truth can regain their authority over the public mind. But look, that may take many years. This is not a quick fix. And there are those radicals on both sides of the spectrum who want immediate change. Our Constitution, as I've said a number of times, prevents wisely immediate change. You have to accept gradual change. But the point about a long-term Senate and no term limits on the House is in order to get accountability, in order to move towards changes that are necessary and can only be accomplished over time. You can see, for instance, in the civil rights area, the civil rights public accommodations law that was passed in 64 has been widely accepted. And I mentioned this before. On the other hand, court order busing was never really accepted. Why? When it was accomplished through the political branches by the people's representatives, it was much more palatable than when done by a life-tenured federal judge who's not accountable and shouldn't be directly accountable to the people. Popular liberty might then have escaped the indelible reproach of decreeing the same citizen, what I skipped here, the part about people of Athens. What he's talking about Socrates and how the people of Athens, first of all, condemn Socrates to drinking the hemlock one day and then statues to him later on. That is the variability of popular opinion. We can see it in our polls, how polls can go up and down very easily because people are moved by emotion often without being moved or to think about things more rationally. The whole point of the Constitution and the design is to produce reasoned process in order to achieve good results. The extended republic is necessary. Yes, we've gone through that before, but it's not sufficient. I have, on the contrary, endeavored in a forward paper to show that it is one of the principal recommendations of a Confederate republic. At the same time, this advantage ought not to be considered as superseding the use of auxiliary precautions. First of all, I mentioned before that the Constitution has redundancy. You don't rely on just one thing. You rely on a number of precautions. So that's one thing. And the other thing, especially today, if we didn't have those precautions, with social media, the internet, television, cable, et cetera, which has shrunk the advantages of the extended republic. It really has. Though these other precautions are even more important than they might have been earlier. Longstanding republics had senates. He talks about Sparta, Rome, and Carthage as the only states to have character can be to which it can be applied. The Anti-Federalists were praising the Greek city-states. The Federalists never did. Other than Sparta, the rest of them didn't have senates, apparently, and they ended up in chaos, as great as Athens was for a period of time. But in the last slide, we just saw the variability in Athens regarding Socrates. So there is the desire and the knowledge by Madison, who read everything there was to read on political theory and political history to understand the problems faced by previous republics. It may still be maintained that there are many points of similitude which render those examples not unworthy of our own attention. That is, we're different, yes, but human nature isn't different. And this is not a perfect constitution, but we have to do the best we can in order to watch out for the same dangers that affected earlier republics. Two houses necessary to protect the people. The people can never willfully betray their own interests, but they may possibly be betrayed by the representatives of the people, and the danger will be evidently greater where the whole legislative trust is lodged in the hands of one body of men than where the concurrence of separate and dissimilar bodies is required in either public act. Again, another aspect of redundancy. The importance of an extended republic, even with representation. It is clear that the principle of representation was neither unknown to the ancients. What he's talking about is that among citizens, there was representation, but not everyone was a citizen. So it's not just representation. But to ensure the advantage, its full effect, we must be careful not to separate it from the other advantage of an extensive territory. For it cannot be believed that any form of representative government could have succeeded within the narrow limits occupied by the democracies of Greece. When I lecture abroad, almost always to smaller countries, I tell them at the beginning, I'm not telling you to adopt the US Constitution as many lawyers, usually representing the ABA, do. I tell them, you can't. You're not big enough. But what you can do is you can have separation of powers. That's required. But the idea of an extended republic, it's not going to work in your country. Opponents will argue that the Senate will become a tyrannical aristocracy. He says the jealous adversaries will claim this tyranny. But the general reply ought to be sufficient that liberty may be endangered by the abuses of liberty as well as the abuses of power. I think a number of people today realize that when many call for liberty or freedom, they mean without any kind of responsibility, without whatever effect it may have on other people. That there are numerous instances of the former as well as of the latter, and that the former rather than the latter is apparently most to be apprehended in the United States. He was absolutely right. And that's an issue that we have to contend with, but have not done so terribly successfully. The Senate cannot be corrupt the government. He goes on to say they have to corrupt all the different institutions of government. By itself, it can't do it. The House is a check of a type on the Senate. If such a revolution should ever happen, he goes on to say it's going to be the House. That is why they're separate. Why, in answer to the earlier question, they don't merge into one. They're always jealous, each of them, of their own power. And if they can take advantage by knocking others as jeopardizing the liberty of the country, they'll do that. And that's built in as part of the protection. So from Leo, we have this. However, it seems that the rise of the breadth and roles of the administrative state has led to the loss of any sort of accountability to elected public offices. Yes, I agree with that. There is an increasing and perverse push to create legislation which is so vague and so defective, which result from its enactment can be traced to the law itself. Do you agree that this, to what extent, and if so, what is the possible remedy? Well, the same remedy over and over again is the administrative state. But one thing is to force Congress to actually read the bills and draft smaller bills. It would be possible if a president came in and said, look, I'm not signing good bills. You give me individual bills on the same subject or I'll veto them. If you set that up at the beginning and you set the ground rules, a president could actually do that. You'd have to be, she'd have to be very strong-willed, obviously. Objections to the Senate as a court of impeachment. Normally, I wouldn't give much time to this, except for the fact that we've had two impeachments in the last couple of years. But it's important that people understand that inherently, impeachment is going to be contentious because of factions. A well-constituted court for the trial of impeachments is an object not more to be desired than difficult to be obtained in a government wholly elective. This jurisdiction. What is the jurisdiction? Abuse or violation of some public trust. They are of a nature which may be peculiarly proprietary by denominated political. The notion that you have to be guilty of a, other than bribery, of a stated criminal offense is clearly wrong. It's about abuse of power. And that's what Democrats were claiming as against the president. The problem is, because of factions, how do you know whether there was a real abuse of power or whether there wasn't? That's why the whole business of impeachment is divided between the two houses. The prosecution of them agitates the passions of the whole community and divides it into parties, more or less friendly or inimical to the accused. Well, we saw that in the last two presidential impeachments. In many cases, it will connect itself with the pre-existing factions and will enlist all of the animosities, partialities, influence, and interest on one side or the other. And in such cases, there will always be the greatest danger that the decision will be regulated more by comparative strength of parties than by the real demonstrations of innocence or guilt. Now, the Senate, he argues, is the most fit depository of this important trust. Those who can best discern the intrinsic difficulty of the thing. Yes, but also they're going to be subject to factions. You just said that. Will be at least hasty in condemning that opinion and will be most inclined to allow the weight and the arguments which may be supposed to be produced. What it may be asked is the true spirit of the institution itself. In the last three presidential impeachments, basically they were dead on arrival when they came to the Senate. That was true of the Clinton impeachment. The Republicans weren't voting for impeachment. The Democrats might have voted in the impeachment for Trump, but they didn't have the numbers. It takes a supermajority, and they didn't have it, and they knew that. So it was dead on arrival. Nevertheless, we went through that whole thing. For what purpose? Well, factions. I mean, some years ago, I was lecturing to some Asian students, and I said something about the Philippines, and a Filipino student objected, saying that their constitution was just like the United States. I said, no, it isn't. And so I asked her, I said, well, how often do you impeach your president? She said, well, every year. And there was a period of time in which they were impeaching every year. Of course, we did that two years in a row ourselves. And in the Philippine constitution, they actually have a provision that says you can impeach a person only once a year. Now, that tells you something, that if we're going to get down to regularly impeaching people, we are headed towards a third world democracy. Where else than in the Senate could this have been found a tribunal sufficiently dignified or sufficiently independent? In other words, there's no real good choice here, but the Senate is the best choice, not the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is not the appropriate one. I'm going to quickly go through because I'm running out of time. Supreme Court would have been an improper substitute for the Senate. Why? Because the numbers. Question. Even though Hamilton believed the Senate would be better suited for the impeachment proceeding than the House or the Supreme Court, the requirement of two-thirds majority in the Senate to remove the president confirms that the founders were concerned with factions, with the worldly knowledgeable Senate as well. Yes, indeed, factions are everywhere. They didn't exclude them from the Senate. So thank you, Emily, for your observation. Federalist 66. The two objections of the Senate as a court of impeachment. they said it violated separation of powers because the Senate was engaging in a judicial action. But they pointed out that this is consistent with the fact that there is not a perfect separation in all of the three departments. The second objection of the Senate, it would give it too much power because of treaties. And then it goes on and says the same thing about appointments. But as pointed out, it doesn't really work that way. First of all, the president nominates, the Senate confirms, but the Senate doesn't appoint. But more importantly, historically, there's only been one cabinet officer who was impeached. The reality is that when a cabinet officer is an irritant and obstructing the president's program in the Congress, the president will get rid of that person without need for impeachment. And in the only impeachments in recent times, as I've said, and mostly have been federal judges. And even those, the Senate has put into a special court and basically can't be bothered with it. They let a smaller group of senators decide and then recommend guilt or innocence to the whole Senate. Fourth objection is the treaty power. Yes, the treaty power is dangerous, but the point is to have joint agency in it. Michael Needle. Michael says it is undoubtedly sound in principle to argue, as Hamilton does, the Senate will rely on evidence of guilt, and that consequently the potential for mischief might be mitigated, but the underlying political culture has weaponized the process. Yes, just commented on that. Comment two, I will also say that irrespective of my criticism of Hamilton and the system he shaped, I cannot for the life of me conceive of an institutional arrangement that would work even half as well. Well, Michael, what you're doing is you're becoming not only anti-federalist, you're now adopting some of the parts of the federalist. And that really is what our country is all about. It is to be a balance between federalism and the anti-federalist elements that deserve it. So thank you for joining us, and come back for the ninth session next week. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Necessary and Proper. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend, and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. To learn more about the Article I initiative, please visit fedsoc.org/articlei. That's fedsoc.org/articlei.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.